Tim and Greg join me today on the Wrinkled Engineer podcast. We're going to discuss the relationship between the International Residential Code and the International Building Code, as well as some of the state variations that exist in that relationship. We're going to complain about speed limits, and we'll share some of our COVID hobbies that have popped up this last year.
Welcome to the Wrinkled Engineer podcast. I'm Gates. Tim is joining us again, and we've also got Greg back. I think this is the second time Greg's been with us.
Yep. Hello.
So today's a topic most structural engineers do not care about until it happens to them. And it's not litigation, although that'd be another one. And so this one's pretty nitty gritty. But before we get into that, Tim is our overlord of pronunciation. You didn't vet this one through me, so I have no idea what's coming out of your mouth. But what's the word this time?
I've done better, but this one's still pretty good. Infrastructure. So I was listening to a video earlier today where the whole topic was infrastructure, and he said infa the whole time, infrastructure. And I'm like, there's an extra R in there. And it means something. It's like, it's the part that makes it inside, you know? So yeah. It's important to get your fra in your infrastructure.
That's fair enough.
Infotainment or something like that. I don't know.
I'd say it's pretty common too. I definitely hear people shorten that word up, and they just try to spit it out as fast as they can because they don't think they're comfortable with it enough, so they just throw it out there as quick as they can. Infrastructure. No.
Yeah, and people do it with infrared. Infrared.
Yeah. You can roll those letters together really
easily.
They
don't like the infra.
Well, cool. That was a pretty benign word for what we normally deal with, but no, that's another subtle one that makes a difference. All right, well, today's wrinkled topic has to do with the Residential Building Code, or the IRC, or the California Building Code Residential, or the Florida Building Code Residential, or any of those other state-specific codes, but more to do with the relationship between the building code and the residential code. And this pain that I experienced, and Greg got some of it too, was on a project that was small in nature, a residential structure, obviously, in LA County, which is a pretty strict county. And most structural engineers, Tim, how well do you know the residential code?
Not well at all.
And I think that's the way it should be. I've always, not that I've looked down at the residential code. I mean, yeah, I've looked down at it, but I always viewed that if I was being hired to work on a project, I was being hired because I'm an engineer, ergo I'm using the building code. The residential code, anybody can use. Some municipalities have some requirements that you be a licensed contractor or a licensed architect. But if you're building your own house, you can pull out the residential code and you can go through the basic calculations and the prescriptive tables and lay out a reasonable home. But it has very rigid boundaries that you have to conform to inside of that document. And when you hit a boundary, a beam that is too long, a shear wall that is too narrow, a diaphragm that's out of a certain aspect ratio, the residential code says, go into the building code and design that element. Get an engineer. He's got to take care of this piece of the puzzle because it exceeds prescriptive boundaries.
He's got to take care of it. Okay, wait. But when that happens, the IRC still holds on to control of the building, right? They just outsource you for that element. And then they say, and then come back to us, right?
So this is a point of clarity that I think needs to be had. So the problem that Greg and I ran into, Greg, what happened in our project?
So we hit that component. Was it a shear wall or a foundation?
Well, we did the entire design for the IBC. Well, the CBC, it's a California project. But we just engineered, because it was an addition, so it was a small roof, some walls, some foundations, some shear walls. We felt using the existing building code and the building code were the right way to approach that, because that's what I do every day. So it's quick and easy. And there is some value to an engineer because you can have better elements than the prescriptive elements. So they might be lighter. They're,
is there some value?
Well, we can discuss one of my gripes with the residential code. But so we went to the building office in the county with our engineered plans. And what happened, Greg?
And he basically told us that certain components, and I think he was saying it was like a city requirement, but they wanted to use certain components from the residential, which then basically forced us to take the whole design into residential code and really redo the design.
Well, we now had to meet the requirements of both the building code and residential code because he wanted us to meet all of the prescriptive requirements of residential code. So we had engineered half-inch anchor bolts in our stud walls. So engineered, we know the reliability of those. Well, the amendment in the LA County is 5/8 is the minimum size. All right. So we had to upsize all those. Foundation size, right? We had designed 12-inch thick by whatever width we needed. Well, residential code 18-inch minimum in LA County for the depth. So our owner, unfortunately, was getting now penalized when the building code was more conservative and penalized when the residential code was more conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And we went in to discuss this with the building official or the plan checker, because he sent us like a 50-page document with all these line items of prescriptive elements that were required that you would give like a homeowner who was trying to design their own house. And so we went through that, and ironically, some of the items we were able to like explain away that we had engineered this, like the discontinuity in a diaphragm, and therefore we didn't need the prescriptive strap, and he bought that, but like the half-inch anchor bolts, he wouldn't allow us to keep.
Yeah, it was almost like some of the items that were an easier checkbox, you know, he's like, no, I need that. I need to see 5/8. But things that were a little bit more, I don't want to say loose, but like you said, prescriptive, right? That's probably the right word. He was okay with the way that we showed him, say, look, this is how it's working. This is how it is engineered to work.
And so I'm in Florida. I've been in Florida for a few years, and I was in Florida when I did this project. And so in the Florida building code, the provisions are you can use the building code or the residential code when the residential code is your one or two family dwelling under a certain size. But you can come back to the building code anytime you want and design elements from the building code. That's the interpretation that exists here in the Florida building code. So I was looking at like an older version of the IBC, and it kind of read that way. And I was looking at the Florida building code, and it read that way. And he pulled out a provision in the California building code that says you can design per the building code or you can design per the residential code, but not both. You pick one or the other. And the only time you can go between the two is when you exceed the boundaries of the residential code, because that's what the residential code tells you to do. It says, go into the building code, solve that problem, and come back. And I agree, you shouldn't be in the residential code and then go cherry pick a provision in the building code that maybe is beneficial to you from an economic standpoint or something like that. But if you go into the building code and grab all of the associated elements that you're designing, all the things that are contingent on each other, I see no problem in saying, I'm going to engineer my lateral system, but my gravity system I'm going to design per the residential code. I've had architects do that where they lay out the beams and columns and walls, but they say, hey, my shear wall design, I just don't want to try and figure that out. Can you just handle lateral? They're not related very closely to one another. They act independent for the most part, and you can gather all the provisions. And the example that the building official gave us is that in LA County, if you want to use engineered foundations, you have to have a geotechnical report. So you can't just assume 1500 PSF, site class D. You have to get a geotech report. So I totally understood that. I said, you know what? We're not going to pay for a geotech report to save $500 worth of concrete. So that's an example where I'm like, let me design that for the IRC and design the rest of the stuff for the IBC. They're not related in how they function. The foundations don't care whether the shear wall is engineered or prescriptive. And so I want to read the language, and this is the boring part because there are some differences. So this forced me, when I came across this problem, like, I want to see where this came from. And it's in the administrative section, chapter one of the building code, which no engineer reads, except for maybe when they're just starting out, right?
Or when they get stuck like this and they're trying to argue with somebody.
Yeah. If it's before chapter 16, we generally don't care.
Right.
And so I'm reading
Volume one, we don't care.
Yeah, and California Title 24 is divided into the architectural section and the structural section, even though definitions and stuff are in the first section. And so what I found is the wording of the relationship between the two codes changed in 2012. The language was the same in 2000, 2003, 2006, 2009, and then changed in 12. And then it's been the same ever since. And I always get concerned when I see a provision in the administrative code that has been consistent since day one, and then suddenly it changed. Who argued for this? What was the impetus for this change?
Right.
Because it's not it's not research into cracked concrete. It's not research into elastic design of steel frames, right? Or seismic. This is administrative code. So this is just legal BS. And somebody felt the need to create this change in the language. And what I found, and we'll read the change in the language shortly, but the IBC made a slight change. California took it a step further, and Florida kept it the same as before. So now we see these divergence of philosophies of the relationship between the building code and the residential code, which is going to cause problems if individual states choose to say that language is dumb or that language isn't strong enough. And so in the early versions of the building code, and so when I say the building code, I'm talking Florida building code, California building code, and IBC, because they all have the same language. It states that detached one and two family dwellings and multiple single family dwellings, like townhouses, not more than three stories above grade, plain in height, with a separate means of egress, and their accessory structures, not more than three stories, shall comply with the International Residential Code. But this is listed as an exception. So the building code says all the things that it's responsible for, and then it says exception, one and two family houses can be designed. Right. Can be designed for the residential code.
Can or shall?
Well, so it says shall comply, but it's an exception, which makes it's not compulsory. You can choose not to follow an exception. Exceptions are at the designer's discretion to use. They're not required. So
that's an interesting point, though, because
we can talk about it,
but the language says take an exception. Shall comply.
Exceptions are there for you to use when you feel like it benefits you. So as an owner of a building, if I'm designing a house, I can say, you know, engineer, I want this engineered, or architect, I want it for the residential code, as long as we meet the provisions. So in 2012, that language changed in the IBC to, it's no longer an exception.
We're going to pause and just clarify a couple of things. First, it was actually the 2018 version of the IBC where the language was changed and not the 2015 version. The exception also has not been removed from the IBC, but it has been changed to where an or has been added that you can design for the IRC or the IBC. It is in the CBC where the exception has been removed.
And so that makes it a little more, now that shall has more force. But if we look at the CBC, it adds additional language. It says, this one, it gives you conditional. It says, may be designed and constructed in accordance with the code or the residential code, but not both, unless the proposed structure or elements exceed the design limitations established in the residential code. And the code user is specifically directed to the California Building Code. So California took it and said, they took away that exception and said, you have to choose between the two, and you can only cross that line when the code tells you you have to. Florida's maintains it as an exception. And what's frustrating is when I did this research like 2 years ago, I know I found a commentary or some document that stated it very clearly, and it helped me understand the relationship. When Florida and Florida and most states adopt the building code, they adopt the international or state-specific building code, which is architecture, structure, and then very small pieces of mechanical, electrical, plumbing. Mm-hmm. By reference, the mechanical code, the plumbing code, the electrical code, the residential code are all then brought in as the legal document of the land, but they're not individually ratified by the state boards. So they accept the IBC and everything else is accepted by reference. California, they accept both in the statute separately, the residential code and the building code. So at least they are consistent by dividing the authority. So the statement I found says the residential code exists as an exception to the building code, and therefore its authority is granted by the building code, not by the statute. So the residential code is this exception that is the building code says you can go to it. It's there for your use, but it is not the legal document that is accepted. So much like chapters or portions of NFPA are adopted in the code by reference, all of NFPA is not adopted because it wasn't in the statutes.
Well, the way those kinds of things usually work is all of the subjugate documents are accepted, and unless the the law says don't. Just like the way California's law says ASCE 7 is accepted, except Chapter 14. Mm-hmm. Don't pay any attention to Chapter 14.
And
don't even look at it.
Florida's interesting because...
I've literally never read it. They've told me, be afraid of Chapter 14. He's the creepy guy that lives next door. Like, don't even talk to him.
So I looked at the Florida statute that adopted the building code, and it's two sentences. And it just says, this version of the Florida building code is adopted, yada, yada, yada. And
right. Then in the Florida building code... Chapter 33, 34, somewhere in there that talks about all of the reference standards.
Yep. Yep.
And all of those standards should be included also, unless the law tells you not to.
And so the beginning in the administrative section of the Florida building code, like it says, seismic provisions are pervasive throughout this document as well as snow design. Ignore all of it. We're not going to go through and edit it, but you don't need to consider it. But in the administrative section,
so lucky.
Yes. In the administrative section where it's outlining the scope of the IBC. So you have ASCE, ACI, all the material codes are specified back in the references. But in the administrative section, it specifically lists mechanical, international mechanical code, international electrical code, international plumbing, fire protection. It lists all those, and then it lists the residential codes only in this. It doesn't list it as a reference. It is only listed in this exception. So I feel that Florida's maintenance of the residential code being subjugated to the building code is correct, and that California's assumption that they are two completely separate documents is erroneous.
Yeah. Yeah. If they're meant to be under the umbrella of the building code, that's how it should be treated, unless you state that it's not acceptable somehow.
Right. And so, like I said, LA County, it caused us a lot of heartburn. And what bothers me the most about the residential code is it's not generally more conservative than the building code, especially in concrete design. That to me, a prescriptive code should always be, 98% of the time, given situations, more conservative than the engineered code when you're comparing apples to apples.
Mm-hmm.
But you can go into the residential code and look at basement walls that are 6 inches thick with rebar at 59 inches on center.
Whoa.
But I can't do that in ACI. I can't go more than 18 inches on center.
Right.
And so to have that big of a disparity between a prescriptive code and an engineered code is difficult for me to understand how, that's why owners like to go to the residential code when they can, because there's lots of lightening that can be done with reinforced concrete that you just can't, and you're not required to put transverse bars in the residential code in your footings.
to the point where you're almost compelling engineers to do things that they're not comfortable with.
Right. And the only time I deal with no transverse reinforced bars is I go to the plain concrete revisions and make sure that my fiber
strong enough to handle it as plain.
It's reasonable. And I never do it with a masonry or concrete wall. I only do it with light frame structures where I'm not worried about fracturing that as a result of the bending of the footing. So any feelings on that, that we have this relationship, the residential code exists and it exists for cheap structures. And because, I mean, I'm going to say it, right? It is not as safe as a building code structure because the risk of one family is not as severe as the risk to public coming to a grocery store or a bunch of people coming to an office, right? Or a theme park inviting guests in, right? There's a lot more liability now. And so they having a higher standard of care makes sense. These are more critical structures than one person's home.
The residential code assumes things like drywall or plaster also. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of redundancy typically in residential structures.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that bothers me about the IRC is they give you a 3-story limit. You can actually go 4 if you have a basement. That's fine. There's no square footage limit. So I've seen 24,000 square foot mansions that are like, can we design this for the IRC? No.
No.
I'm sorry.
You're going to run into limits all over the place.
Yeah, we're not going to do that because this is larger than some people's commercial buildings.
Right.
And that doesn't feel good as an engineer to say, I'm going to design this as a house when it's functioning at a much higher level. You know, higher end materials, more steel framing, more concrete over metal deck, things like that that you don't, you know, you're not going to get in a normal.
It's
house.
More like a commercial facility at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the higher end homes too, you're typically doing larger gathering rooms. And so you're going to meet some of those limitations in the residential code for
you're going to run into
beam length and
big spans, bigness.
this is off topic. But I did this spiral staircase, which to meet building code for rise and run, you have to have a really large radius. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you get too small of a wedge.
Right.
And we were looking at bent and radius tube steel to make those mm-hmm. stringers. There's nothing in the residential code that would come close to how you could account for those forces. And so I think I've
that
covered...
would just be one of the instances where they farm you out to the building code and then you would come back.
Yeah.
Because that stairway is not holding up the building if you did it right.
No, but it's sure imparting a lot of force onto, you know, onto the framing of that structure where it lands.
Yeah.
So that's...
Although Gatesu and I have been in a building where the stairway is actually stiffer and stronger than the building itself. You know, well, anyway, we're not going to get too far into that.
Yeah. So again, it's just I'm frustrated that as an engineer I'm told I can't go use advanced analysis techniques and use my judgment to make sure that I consider all the affected variables.
Right.
When the avenue exists for the residential code to tell you to go do that, only it doesn't tell you to consider all the variables. It just says if this beam is outside the scope, go design that beam. What about the connections? What about the columns? What about, you know, all those other things that are now
the part that seems worse to me is that an owner or contractor could come back to you and say, your design is overly conservative.
Yeah absolutely. Because they go, in this table, it says that, you know, my rebar can be at 72 inches. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I was looking up in that subsection of the code that you found, you know, it's under the heading of conflicts. Right. So the section up is just kind of talking about, you know, hey, when this code conflicts with any other part of the California building standards codes, mm-hmm. You know, the most restrictive requirement shall prevail.
Yeah.
So it's at first I was like, well, OK, were they trying to protect you then by not having to read both? And then, like you said, you engineer the half inch bolt, but then because the other one says 5/8, you have to go 5/8. Were they trying and they just kind of, you know, missed the mark a little bit?
That seems to negate the entire purpose of a residential code, because it makes it sound like you have to know both, you have to check both, and whichever one is harder, you have to do that one.
Well, that's I think that's only when when you're kicked from one to the other. And I forgot. So one of the major flaws with the way it's worded currently in California is it says you have to choose the building code or the residential code.
Right.
But I know that the architect could use the residential code and the engineer could use the building code. But that's not what the provision says. The entire design team should have to use one or the other. And that seems completely bogus too, because why does the mechanical engineer care if the structural engineer and the architect are using the building code? It's
They're basically what they're doing is they're doing a cover your ass thing of like interactions between trades and things that they hadn't thought of.
Right. They didn't state it. This is discipline by discipline. It says you use one or the other. And you know, that works when you're the architect and you're doing all of it on a house, on a single family home that you're just going to go ahead and do all of the disciplines because it's within your authority as an architect. But when you start bringing on design teams for larger houses or more complicated work that are still residential work, so it's the architect get to dictate what you use, and now you've let him make a structural engineering decision by choosing the code. But they don't enforce it. So it's one of those things where I guess it doesn't matter because it's not enforced that way, but it is written that way. That would be a fun comment, wouldn't it? Like, two disciplines used the building code and three didn't. And which one of you guys are going to redo your design? That would be.
Sounds like you need to limit the size of the residence.
I think, I think it should be limited to 10,000 square feet at a maximum. I mean, that's
10,000.
Well, because you can do duplexes.
Gates wants to do a big house.
Well, who does?
I would limit it to four.
Four? Even with duplexes? Mm-hmm. So two 2,000 square foot duplexes or a single 4,000 foot resident? That's probably is more reasonable. I don't know. That's what I have.
Go to the building code. It's not that hard. The fact is you don't need the IRC. It's a convenience.
And I have more confidence in a half inch anchor bolt that's been engineered at 48 inches on center than I do a prescriptive 5/8 bolt at 48 inches on center.
Right.
Because I know the numbers have been looked at closely, and Appendix D has been applied, so concrete breakout's not an issue. And that is not the case with that stupid table that they have on the allowable concrete anchor loads. It's like, I even had a Simpson bolt or base plate that had a half-inch anchor bolt. I'm like, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to upsize the base plate or the base connection? Or can I just use a half-inch bolt? Because it's been tested. We know it's valid, and they actually let us use the half-inch bolt. Because I'm like, that throws out half the baseplate anchors, because they're all half-inch. Until you get to the hog boys that have the 7/8 and 3/4. And so, all right, I think that's enough, unless Tim threatened he might, or hinted he might argue with me on this one.
No, I was just trying to frighten you.
Yeah, okay. I was waiting for a lawsuit that Tim found from like 20 years ago, but...
Yeah.
That's good. All right, well, speaking of laws and legal, so my fun topic, as Tim knows, I don't like speed limits very much on the highway. They concern me. They rankle me. Our city council in one of the towns in Orange County, there's a strip of set of highways that goes through it, and they decided last week they wanted to vote on raising the speed limit from 55 to 60 miles an hour. And the only data that was provided in the news was that the average speed was over 65 miles an hour and that 80% of the traffic on the roadway was traveling faster than 65 miles an hour.
Okay, so it sounds like at least they did some kind of a study.
Well, yeah, so they knew that people weren't adhering to the speed limit, which I can understand. And they had their city engineer who made the comment that traffic flowing at the same speed is safer than traffic flowing with a delta, which I get. The larger the delta, the more likelihood of bad accidents. So the assumption is if you raise the speed limit to 60, maybe those 20% of traffic will get closer to the average. And that's all well and good, but I've got my son in the car now for like 40 minutes every day each way to his school. And it was on the radio when we heard that, and I said, why is it inappropriate that the city council is voting on the speed limit?
Right.
And he thought about it for a minute, and he was trying to think about it from do they have the authority? Is it the right legislative body? And I'm like, no. you've got to think about this from an engineering standpoint. And I said, if only there was a way to analytically determine what the speed limit of the roadway should be. They said, if only, you know, my transportation book tells me how to design roadway speed, all based on stopping distance and reaction time and all that fun stuff. And so that I've given this rant many times to many people who know me, and that is when I was in transportation engineering, we would go through calculations of roadways in the Phoenix area because I went to Arizona State. And we get freeway speeds of like 98 miles an hour, 107, you know, 113 miles an hour because it's a wide road, really straight. And you're going, why is the speed limit 75 out in the middle of the desert? Because the legislature says you have an engineer speed limit, but then you have what we'll allow. And it's completely dictated by the government, which I understand that. But I feel like we're stuck in this 65 mile an hour rut that somehow we all think that that's this magical speed where cars are most efficient and most safe and all the trade-offs are at this balance point. It's at the top of the curve. And that's just, that's not true. This is just an arbitrary number that's been established. Yeah. And other than during the gas crisis when the speed limit was 55, because that was the prevailing efficient speed, right? Or supposedly. There's really no reason for feelings to enter into this idea of speed limits like the city council, I felt, was doing. They were reacting to the people and not the analysis that some transportation engineer probably did. And he probably calculated at 80 miles an hour and some bureaucrat said, nope, we're not going to have anything over 55 in our city because it's safer, right? And safety.
It's a safety. You're trying to control user behavior. Yeah. Right. So I do think there's some validity there to the engineer should be doing a study to say, okay, what is the safe speed based on that criteria? But then legislation should be able to come in and go below that and say, well, we know based on the number, you know, 70 works, but because, you know, we don't want people going up and down speeds, but we're going to go 65.
Right. And there's something to be said, like if you have a stretch of freeway that's 90 and then all of a sudden it drops down to 70 because it curves. And I've told my son, I'm like, and you're on a road that's 45 miles an hour and it drops to 35 and then goes back up to 45. That's probably engineering governed. The roadway probably gets narrow or there's a blind curve or there's driveways or something that impact. You know, the 45 is probably not engineered limited, but that 35 mile an hour stretch is where they said, no, we have to account for that.
Or the city just needs a revenue generating speed trap. You know, they just
the police department's on it.
Spot. Yeah. Gotta make some.
So as I was thinking about this more in depth this week, the other aspect, I was talking to my father, he's in town, and I said, the difficulty with having an artificially lowered speed limit is that the DOT establishes the goals, right? The criteria for deaths per person, million miles driven, you know, loss of property and injuries and all those things. So there's a statistical baseline of acceptable loss.
Mm-hmm.
And the speed limits are normalized to, you know, the equations are normalized to hit that goal, those requirements. If you have artificially low speeds, those roadways are going to perform better than the anticipated baseline. And then if you have a stretch of roadway that's closer to the engineered speed and it's performing right at the tolerance, it's going to look much worse. And they're going to think, we got to do something with that intersection or at that stretch of roadway because it looks so much worse. It's got twice as many fatalities. Well, yeah, but because you're going 40 miles an hour below the speed limit that would produce that many fatalities on the other roadways. And so now you have a feedback loop that's being imposed not by the engineers in the DOT, but by legislatures.
Well, it's an erroneous comparison at that point. Yeah. And that should be the end of the discussion.
Yeah, that you can't have. But we never see this data, right? They never. Politicians are idiots and they're not going to tell us what the engineer said because I don't know why. Tim, what's it like in Germany? Because this is what drives me nuts about. In the city, absolutely we have to have reasonable speed limits because there's so much traffic. But having driven across the Sonoran Desert many, many, many times.
Yeah, well, obviously in Germany, the people are better drivers. I mean, more educated.
Well, and I know there's definitely a difference in the caliber of the driver. the quality of the automobiles for a long time tended to be better, and not as many people had drivers.
No, they objectively are there. I have friends in Germany who complain up and down about the inspection processes of their vehicles.
And not everybody has a license. It's a more expensive process. It's not this right. It's a privilege mentality in those countries.
It's more of a privilege than it is here. It's a right in the United States, regardless of what people say. Everybody looks at, they're like, oh no, I have a right to drive.
So I understand there's some of those differences. But like I said, having driven across Phoenix to LA 80 times in the period of 18 months, each way, that it's inconceivable that a country as small as Germany can have no limits between its major cities that are 10 or 30 miles apart.
Yeah.
But in America, where we're hundreds of miles from population centers, oh, no, 75. And you should be grateful it's not 70 or 65. We can get into
I feel lucky when I get on a stretch that's 75. I'm like, yes, okay, now I'm not going 20 miles an hour, the speed limit. I'm only going 10.
Oh, see, I adjust accordingly. It's all about percentages in my mind.
See, Texas has a toll road between Austin and San Antonio that I think the speed limit is 80 miles an hour.
I thought it was 85. I know there's the stretch.
It might be 85.
There's a stretch in Wyoming, and then there's the stretch in Utah that makes me cry on I-15 that's 80 miles an hour. And it's like, oh, it's so beautiful.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Really, 85 would make me feel much better.
Well, I think it's closer to it. And when you start learning about the design criteria, it's like 0 to 60 stopping in 200 feet is like the design criteria. And there's not a car made that won't do it in under 100.
Right.
So we're designing for, a Lincoln built in 1972. Mm-hmm. with drum brakes.
I've been thinking about self-driving cars, right? And I was thinking about, well, maybe this is our opportunity to change the criteria for people who are actually going to pilot their own automobiles, as opposed to those who are relegated to riding around in self-driving cars, right? Maybe you need much more stringent criteria to actually drive a car yourself.
And I've been working on that in my brain, a classed driver system, for a long time. I think that's a topic for another day, but should be a way.
If you think about like the bell curve of speeds, for example, let's say that some people are qualified to drive 130 miles an hour, right? Well, then you've got a very broad bell curve of speeds. And what do you really need to do? You need to chop off the lower ends.
Yeah.
Right.
Force them to self-driving.
You need to disqualify those people, so that the faster people can drive faster.
Well, it was always funny because we talked about you design for the middle 90%. So you cut off the top 5 and the bottom 5. And that's what the criteria is based on for stopping distance and reaction time. I'm like, but hold on. The top 5% is going to perform better than everybody below them. So we're really designing for the 6th percentile and above. That's pretty low bar.
Can't we just throw them in jail or something? I mean,
and the last gripe I have on roadway design, because I hear this in the news, you hear it repeated by people all the time, and you even hear law enforcement officers quoted in the news. Mm-hmm. When it rains, they always say, "Remember what about the speed limit?
It should slow down.
It's for dry conditions," and that is false. It's for wet conditions, but not water-shedding conditions. So as long as the roadway is just damp, and I have the textbook with the line item that says we consider wet conditions for stopping distance, but not ice or water-shedding. So if it's raining really hard and you actually have water, bubbling up on the surface of the road, slow down.
Every state subscribes to something called the basic speed law, where they say you should never drive faster than conditions permit.
Feel safe.
Even when the posted speed limit says something, the basic speed law always overrides the posted speed limit.
But in general, the roadway, if it's just damp, mm-hmm. that is design condition for the speed limit.
Yeah.
So don't slow down when it's just drizzling
outside. And something that they do in Florida, don't drive with your freaking hazard lights on just because of the downpour.
Or your windshield wipers they do, on all
Greg,
the way.
They do that in Florida.
Do they really?
Yeah, people start getting freaked out and they turn on their hazard lights because they do this whole monkey see, monkey do thing where they're like, must be what we're supposed to do.
So I'm curious about the data. Do you think it's the locals or those who visit and are like, oh my goodness, this is more rain than we've ever seen?
I think it's a combination. And I think as soon as somebody sees somebody else doing it, they're like, oh yeah, me too. And they do it.
And it goes as far.
I don't think you should ever drive with your hazard lights on.
No, and in Florida, the laws are more stringent about it than California. In Florida, you're not allowed to have your hazard lights on unless you're at a stop on the side of the road. You're not even allowed to be in motion with your hazard lights on. And nobody knows that, but it's in the driving statutes. In California, you're allowed to use them while you're moving, but only to get over to the side.
Yeah, and sometimes when it's raining, they'll throw up on the message boards, like, yep, don't drive with your hazards on.
Oh, they've gone that far now. Yeah. Oh, good for them.
People still do it, and you're just, or it's like, it's barely raining, and their windshield wipers are going the highest setting, and you're like, this is Florida. I feel like you want to have a little bit left for when it actually rains. Yeah. Like, I don't want to use that all up and then go, oh crap, now it's really raining. I want a more consistent driving experience.
Since we maintain our windshield wipers, I've driven in people's cars
this is,
who don't.
This is true.
Well, and I can see why they're terrified. I can't see when I'm in their car either.
And I prescribed to the just go faster and the water will sheet off. And yeah. then you don't need windshield wipers.
Step on it. That'll solve it.
Yes,
I'm still a Rain-X guy. Use Rain-X.
This is true. Yeah, that's tough. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you can remember the chemical compound. It's silicone based, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Have we talked about enough?
I think so. We've gone way off mark. So
there's no need for this last topic.
Give me. You said you had something fun, so I want to hear
it. It's not that fun. It's a little bit fun.
Okay. Well,
COVID hobbies.
COVID hobbies.
Yeah, like what have you picked up because of COVID that you would never have otherwise? There is literally a piano in my house now that wouldn't have been there if it hadn't been for COVID.
So I would say the Rankled Engineer is a part of COVID, but...
Is it part of a COVID hobby?
But I don't know that...
I'm sitting here?
I don't know that that's true because I didn't... My work has not changed at all other than I worked from home for a while. So my life stayed pretty much the same. And, you know, we're Wild West or East out here in Florida. So my life stayed really pretty much the same.
Right.
But so this is something I've wanted to do. And I think being at home a little more has given me the time. But I also finished my remodel during COVID.
Okay.
And so I didn't have any time for 18 months to pursue anything other than a remodel. And so that gave me more time than COVID, but I would say my build videos now, that's definitely, I think, COVID related. That's kept me.
What about you, Greg?
I don't know that I've had anything new because coming into this, we just had a brand new baby.
Yeah, so he's got youngin. He's got a lot of youngins.
We were already had 2020 planned for extra child care.
You were already given a hobby. Yeah,
it was 9 months in the making, and then like
we weren't even sure how we were going to handle that.
If you look at my shop,
we're outnumbered,
obviously cleaning and organizing, has not made the COVID list.
Oh, yeah. The only thing I was starting to do, was start to do some computer programming and some database stuff just to help with some of our systems at work. But I got started in it and got set up, and then just getting to the tip of the iceberg before work really started getting busy, and I haven't stopped since. So
that's fun.
Hoping to get back to it.
We need to get some recordings of Tim playing the piano. I want to hear him tickling the ivories.
Right. So
is it some ragtime or is it classical piano?
No, I'm not trash. So it's been. It's been bizarre because, well, I haven't had a piano around for a long time. And I'm like, I don't remember anything. And then all of a sudden I remember, oh yeah, I used to know this song. And then like maybe a couple of days later, I just try to start to play it And I do this thing where I like look up at the wall and just try to let my hands do it. And it freaking works. It's so weird. Brains are so bizarre. The way they remember stuff, it's like, it's unbelievable sometimes. Like, as long as I'm not watching my hands and thinking about it, I'm like, it like still works. It's really weird. So yeah, some things have been coming back to me. I'm trying to learn some new stuff. You know, it's fun.
I've been teaching a teenager how to drive, but specifically we just started manual transmission.
Oh, my God.
That's
been... Did you increase your chiropractic coverage?
Well, I'm not. He turned 16 in a few months, and I'm not ready for that insurance hit. That's going to
I just saw a statistic. 18% of Americans can drive a manual transmission.
And wow. I'm torn. I want to be a good father because I feel like it's an essential life skill you should have. And
yeah, if you plan on renting a car in Europe, guess what?
Yeah.
But there's times I'm like, I just don't want to do this. This is not fun. And I know somebody taught me and I should teach him, but there's just times where it's like, and you know, when the car starts to stutter, it's like, push the clutch in, and he just forgets to. And like, if you ever get it in trouble, just put the clutch in and it resets everything.
The clutch.
Yeah, like just that's all it. You have to do. And he just like refuses to think of that. I'm like, you gotta get this muscle memory down.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And my mom took him driving, and she hasn't driven in a manual in probably 10 years, and it's like playing the piano, right? It's just, you just remember how to do it.
Yeah, it comes back.
Yeah, it comes back.
Pretty quick.
All right, gentlemen. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. Have a good one. We will see everybody later, and check us out on all the other social media platforms and our other videos. Have a good one from the Wrinkled Engineer, Tim and Greg.
Bye.
Bye-bye-bye.